This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food, and a beer garden, all organized by creative collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy as well. Hump Day PDX is June 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. and every second Wednesday of the month thereafter at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Board Elections 2013. KBOO members, do you have talents in fundraising, development, or new media? Are you excited about the possibilities for KBOO's future?
Are you an active member? Then here's your chance to bring your know-how to the KBOO Foundation Board of Directors.
Applications are now being accepted until June 28th, with candidate training on June 30th. To apply, go to kboo.fm/board elections or email kbooelections@gmail.com.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland will grant a $2.3 million settlement for police brutality victim William Kyle Monroe.
U.S. soldier Robert Bales pleads guilty to 16 counts of premeditated murder in Afghanistan.
And Washington nuclear plant has been leaking for the past 42 years.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 5th, 2013. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Nia Lewis. The Portland City Council today voted to approve a nearly $1 million settlement for William Kyle Monroe, who was shot by a Portland police officer with live shotgun rounds in 2011 and permanently disabled. Officer Dane Raister claimed that he believed he was firing non-lethal beanbag rounds, but in fact fired live rounds. Commissioner Amanda Fritz questioned Jim Rice, the deputy city attorney, at this morning's City Council meeting.
Could you give us some more details about what the police are doing to make sure that this does not happen again?
It's sort of interesting when I got into this. When I was hired, Mayor Potter told me, he said, Jim, how do we never do the right thing first? And then number two, how do we never have this happen again? So I have quite a bit of firearms training from the military and whatnot. And I went over and talked with Assistant Chief Larry O'Day and gave some of my opinions what might be done. First, I actually have photographs here I could show you. For example, the buckshot rounds are bright red. The beanbag rounds are, I'm going to call it, milky white. So there's this sort of very obvious difference between the two. And, of course, a question in my mind was, well, how could a person mix this up? I also sort of imagine everything wrong in life, so I went over and asked, I mean, how are these shotguns loaded? And I was shown that they would open the car door of the vehicle, they place the shotgun in a carrier or something that snaps in place between the two seats, and the officer would sit in the seat, and I will demonstrate what I believe was they would take the round and place them in the tube that's beneath the barrel of the shotgun. So essentially, the round is really almost going directly in front of your face when this happens. And the coloration, I mean, is already, you know, significantly different. How do we keep people from, in an industrial or work setting, from paying attention to everything they do? But what they're doing now is keeping the officer themselves. In October of 2011, this new regulation came out. They're not going to permit the officer to have both kinds of ammunition on themselves. So we start with that premise that it would be much more difficult to mix the ammunition up. Before this, the officers did have that ability to have them with themselves, and some of them did various things.
Are our police officers tested for colorblindness?
You know, I don't know. That's a very good question, because my memory of this, and I haven't studied this for a long time, red color blindness, I believe, is one of the more common types of color blindness. And they see green, but I think they see green. I actually did it with a strawberry picker case once.
Well, I did my master's thesis on color preferences, and we were obviously, if you're testing color preferences, you have to test for color blindness, and we actually found that one of our subjects, a student, who didn't know that he was colorblind, and especially for red-green, I believe that they all go to shades of gray. So the fact that you and I could see bright red versus milky white might not necessarily be the case. So I think that's another question that's worth looking into. We need to really dig down. If we have a serious error like this, even though it's a one-time, and I appreciate the research to see if it happens elsewhere, I think we should be looking at every single factor, and I appreciate knowing that there's not even carrying the same bullets. I wonder how they're stored and how it's made sure that, you know, that the right things are put in the right place even.
Absolutely. I want to follow up on this, and they may test them for color blindness. I just have never encountered that particular problem, but I will talk with the training division and find out if they do that. Should they not test for it, I would certainly urge that be one of the qualifications for at least to know about it,
right,
whether
awareness.
Or not the police officer has that impediment in their vision.
That was Portland City Attorney Jim Rice speaking with City Commissioner Amanda Fritz at this morning's City Council meeting. For more on this story, KBOO's Jennifer Kemp spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
Give us some background information on the case of William Kyle Monroe and Officer Dane Reister.
Back in 2011, Mr. Monroe was in a southwest Portland neighborhood somewhere near a playground, and people got nervous about his presence. Mr. Monroe had a mental illness, and he was acting strangely, they thought. So they called the police. After emptying his pockets out, Mr. Monroe was told to kneel on the ground. When he asked why, Officer Dane Reister fired his shotgun at him, thinking he had loaded it with less lethal, quote-unquote, beanbag rounds, which are really nylon sacks filled with lead shot. And instead, he had loaded his shotgun with live rounds, and he shot Mr. Monroe four times, and his gun jammed on the fifth effort to fire the gun again. The injuries permanently disabled Mr. Monroe, and he's lucky to be alive, frankly.
What repercussions, if any, has Reister sustained for his actions?
Well, as far as we know, Reister is on administrative leave because he's pending a criminal trial for what he did. The district attorney charged him with assault charges and tried to then add on top of that negligent firing of a weapon charge that's normally reserved for hunters. And the judge said you can't apply that in this case because he's not a hunter. And the district attorney's pursuing that. He's appealed that ruling. So the criminal trial has been on hold for several months now, unfortunately. This is the first time in the history of the county that a Portland police officer has been indicted for on-duty use of force. And I think the community would like to see this move quicker and, certainly either he's guilty of the assault charges or not. What we're afraid of is that these other charges, the assault charges are felonies and the other charges are misdemeanor, and we're afraid that the DA is going to try to settle for the lesser charge, and that's why he's pushing so hard to get this charge added.
William Kyle Monroe's case is one of many in past years of Portland police using excessive force on people who are mentally ill and in distress but not necessarily dangerous, like Aaron Campbell and James Chassie. Do you see a pattern here?
Oh, definitely. Obviously, I'm not alone. The U.S. Department of Justice came in here and declared that they found a pattern in practice. Unfortunately, their study lasted for a period, you know, they were only looking for a period of about a year and a half, and we at Portland Cop Watch have been around for 21 years, and one of the things that you noted is these two other cases, Aaron Campbell and James Chassie, resulted in large settlements from the city. Mr. Campbell's family received $1.2 million, and Mr. Chassie's family received $1.6 million, and this is a $2.3 million settlement, and we speculate that, one of the reasons is that Mr. Monroe lived, that normally when a person gets shot by the police, they're dead and they can't tell their story about what happened. In this case, the police had, they knew they had a witness who could say exactly what happened, and they admitted fault. We know Riestra has a history of being short-tempered because there was a person who videotapes police officers around town named Joe Anybody, calls himself Joe Anybody, who several years ago was videotaping Riestra harassing a man in the street downtown, and Riestra seized Joe Anybody's camera, and he filed a suit about that, asking for very little money in damages, but to change the policy about whether or not it's okay to videotape police, and as a result, there's now a policy in Portland that says you can videotape police. But it all stems from Riestra acting hastily and incorrectly.
I was speaking to Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch, and this is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News.
The Oregon State Senate today passed a bill that will allow the footage from red light cameras to be used as evidence in other crimes. One senator spoke against the bill before it passed.
Colleagues, George Orwell wrote a book, 1984. The government is watching. We're dealing with drones. We're dealing with red light surveillance. We're dealing with complete government takeover of everything we do. It says on my blue sheet that the pictures and video from photo red light cameras can currently be used only to enforce traffic laws. Fine. This allows photo red light cameras to record 24/7 surveillance and be used in any criminal prosecution. 24/7. They're watching. Thank you, Madam President.
Further discussion? Not Senator Pazansky, do you wish to close?
Madam President, I just want to put on the record that there's been some questions as to how this may be used. If you have an individual that is actually, making flight from robbing a bank, and if they went through a red light that had one of the photo red light cameras there, under the current law, we would not be able to use that to mark the time and place of where this individual was in relation to the bank robbery. What this will allow for those situations where someone is have committed a felony or a Class A misdemeanor, and they are, let's say, in flight or some other way that we could use it, we could put them in conjunction with the crime that they have been accused of committing. This would allow it for be used in evidence. It would not be able to be used for other purposes. Thank you, Madam President.
Another bill which passed the Oregon Senate today will require U.S. flags to be flown in all charter school classrooms in the state. Although some groups, including the ACLU, initially opposed the bill, they withdrew their objections when an amendment was added to not require students to say the Pledge of Allegiance every day.
House Bill 3014A comes to you from the Senate Education Committee, unanimous vote. It basically involves our flags in our public schools. Presently, public schools have to have American flags in all their classrooms and allow at least a period of time, at least once a week, for the saluting of the American flag. Enter 3014A, it basically said that it should apply to charter schools as well as to say the salute should take place at least once a day that the school is in session per classroom, and that the Pledge of Allegiance should be led by a student or a teacher. The Senate Education Committee amended the bill to say go back to the once a week standard that exists in state law, but to also keep into the bill the provision that the House put in that it applied to charter schools. Nice piece of legislation. We're a big flag state. We're the only state in the nation that has walk of flags, which is just outside here. And so I hope you can find your way to go green on House Bill 3014A. Thank you, Madam President.
Both of these bills passed the Senate and will now go to Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber for his signature.
A coalition of Northwest environmental groups, led by the Sierra Club, filed a lawsuit today in federal court, charging coal companies with polluting the Columbia River. The lawsuit comes in the midst of an ongoing controversy regarding proposals to build coal export terminals in Oregon and Washington. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Sasha Cairns of the Oregon branch of the Sierra Club.
Can you tell us about the lawsuit that your group filed today?
Today, the Sierra Club and our partners at Puget Sound Keeper, Columbia River Keeper, Resources for Sustainable Communities and also Friends of the Columbia Gorge, filed a lawsuit against Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad Company and several other coal companies, including Peabody, Amber Energy, and Cloud Peak. 2 months ago, we had sent a notice of intent to sue letter to them based on the fact that we have discovered that they've been illegally discharging coal dust and chunks and other potentially dangerous material into the Columbia River, into Puget Sound, and into other Northwest waterways, violating the Federal Clean Water Act.
And what is your lawsuit demanding happen to these coal companies? Will they have to shut down their operations or just cover the coal cars or what?
Well, this lawsuit, you know, is basically just wanting to hold them accountable for their mess. And there are a variety of solutions that the companies could pursue, but we're leaving that up to them, and we're just asking that they take care of the problem.
Doesn't the Clean Water Act already cover these types of coal dust?
So that is actually the heart of our lawsuit, that yes, the Clean Water Act intended to protect our health and our quality of life and the quality of the water, and that this is illegal pollution that's going on from the point source, which are the coal trains in this case. So these companies are violating the Clean Water Act by polluting with coal dust.
How will this impact the proposals to bring more coal trains through Oregon to export terminals?
Well, the fact that we've been discovering so much coal accumulating from the existing amount of rail traffic just illustrates and underscores the looming threat of new coal export proposals in the Northwest. So if we're discovering this amount of coal accumulating now, it's certainly only going to increase with adding 20 or more trains a day coming through our communities for the number of proposals that we're looking at for coal exports. So I think there are a lot of community members who live in these areas that are connected to the Puget Sound and the Columbia River and other places in the Northwest that are alarmed by what they're finding and want to make sure that that this problem is taken care of, that the coal dust that is being illegally discharged at this point is enclosed, but also that we take note of this and realize how much we should be preventing new projects from coming on board, given the threats that we're facing now and could continue to face.
And what is the status of the coal terminals that are currently proposed for the Oregon and Washington coast?
Of the six that had initially been proposed a few years ago, the one that is farthest along that folks in Oregon should be particularly concerned about and noting is the Port of Morrow project that would be close to Boardman, Oregon, along the Columbia River. And that project by that's being proposed by Amber Energy, an Australian company, is going to be looking at having air permit hearings in the next month and a half or so. So coming up on July 9th, there's going to be a public hearing in Portland to talk about the draft air permit that's come out from the DEQ for this project. And this is a pretty urgent matter because if this air permit goes forward, then we will be seeing the first coal export project in the Northwest being permitted right here in Oregon.
So that's July 9th at the Oregon Convention Center. Are there other hearings or events coming up that people should be aware of?
If you'd like to get more involved in organizing to prevent these coal export terminals, there is going to be a Sierra Club Coal Export Task Force meeting coming up in Portland on Tuesday, June 25th at 7 p.m., and that would be here at the Sierra Club office at 1821 Southeast Ankeny Street. And there will be a variety of different public engagement opportunities coming out of that to make sure that Oregon families are informed of this threat and that they can come and stand up and ask for the DEQ and Governor Kitzhaber to protect us from the threat of coal export.
And again, if people want more information, the website powerpastcoal.org will have these events listed. Again, I've been speaking with Sasha Kearns with the Oregon branch of the Sierra Club. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A new report by the U.S. Department of Energy has found that a nuclear storage tank at Hanford Nuclear Plant in Richland, Washington, has been leaking for the last 42 years. The tank is the size of an Olympic swimming pool and is used to store radioactive waste. This is one example of the numerous problems at Hanford that have earned the facility the distinction of being one of the most environmentally contaminated sites in the nation. Workers at Hanford helped produce plutonium for the bombs that brought an early end to World War II, thereby saving the lives of millions of American and Allied soldiers. However, Hanford has struggled for nearly a quarter of a century to eliminate the risk from the 56 million gallons of toxic waste stored there in the aging underground storage tanks. The Energy Department spends roughly $2 billion yearly, or one-third of its budget, seeking to clean up Hanford. A new waste plant is being built that would resolve the problems at Hanford, but construction has been put on hold until the Energy Department can resolve compounding problems.
Today marks the World Environment Day, which was established by the United Nations in 1972 and is celebrated by more than 130 countries each year. This year, the United Nations Environment Program has named the city of Portland the North American host for World Environment Day. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Cassie Cohen of Groundwork Portland, which is organizing one of the events to celebrate World Environment Day.
Explain the Portland Harbor Community Coalition. What are the objectives and how are you organizing?
The Portland Harbor Community Coalition was formed to bring together diverse community members and community members that are affected by the contamination in the river from either fishing along the banks of the river or even folks experiencing homelessness that might be camping and sleeping along the banks of the river, to get all of these folks together to raise voices, community voices, so they are able to impact the decisions that are coming very soon on exactly how clean the river will become and the ways of cleaning the river and the extent of cleaning the river.
I imagine this is going to be a fairly spendy project over a period of time. Can you tell me how the funds are being generated? Are the polluters picking up the tab?
Definitely the responsible parties will have to be paying large percentages of the cleanup. They will all be dividing up the costs. Now, the city and the Port of Portland are also potentially responsible parties and will eventually most likely be named fully responsible parties. So it remains to be seen what that means for taxpayers.
Are you at liberty to share here with me now some of the names that might be on that list?
Well, like I said, the city of Portland is, the Port of Portland is, the Department of Defense is, those are public entities, and then many companies. So Gunderson is one, and the list goes on.
What opportunities are in play for folks who'd like to get involved?
The Portland Harbor Community Coalition is open for anyone who would like to join, who would like to express their opinions and also help to reach out to the broader community to find out what more community members would like to see have happen with the Willamette River. So it's an open group, and they can contact Groundwork Portland. They'd like to get involved, groundworkportland.org.
That was Cassie Cohen of Groundwork Portland. The group is holding an educational event beginning at 5:30 this evening titled Portland Harbor Superfund Cleanup 101 at 3802 Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard on the second floor. The event will run from 5:30 to 8 tonight and is open to the public.
Various groups in the state of Oregon have signed a settlement to hopefully protect the less than 50 wolves in the state. The settlement may offer protection while, at the same time, appease groups like cattle ranchers. Rob Clavins of Oregon Wild explains the history and significance of this settlement.
Unfortunately, we had a government-sponsored program where we hunted, trapped, and poisoned wolves until the point where they had all been killed in the state of Oregon. Ultimately, we as a society decided we didn't want to make species go extinct on purpose anymore, so we had the Endangered Species Act in 1973. In 2005, the state brought together stakeholders that included hunters and biologists, ranchers, folks from the conservation community, and the public at large, and they created a wolf plan that was a compromise. It was not a scientific plan, but it was a social and political compromise. The plan set incredibly low recovery goals for wolves in Oregon, but it also said that killing wolves would be an option of absolute last resort. Unfortunately, not everybody stood by that compromise, and there was great political pressure from some who didn't want to see wolves ever return to the landscape, and they put a lot of pressure on the state's wildlife agency every time a cow went missing. And what we ended up seeing was the state was bending to political pressure and being far too quick on the trigger to kill wolves. So in 2011, the state issued a kill order for several members of the Omnaha Pack in northeastern Oregon in Wallowa County. And so conservation groups, including Oregon Wild and Cascade Wildlands, went to court and challenged the legality of the state's wolf-killing program. A judge ruled that we were likely to succeed on the merits of our case and issued an injunction that stopped the state from killing wolves. So over the last 18 months, the conservation groups have worked hard with the state as well as the Oregon Cattlemen's Association to come with a solution that gets us back to the wolf plan we thought we had in 2005, where the state was going to prioritize conservation of what is still a very endangered species. And thankfully, that's what we have in this settlement, in this agreement that we've made with the state.
Activists like Clavin are hopeful that the settlement will be able to increase a sustainable wolf population, even if they are delisted as a federally protected endangered species.
In 2011, Congress delisted wolves from the endangered species list. It was the first time that Congress had substituted their judgment for that of science. And as part of a budget deal in 2011, a Democratic Senator John Tester from Montana and the Obama administration, with support from the Obama administration, delisted wolves in much of the western United States, including eastern Oregon. Wolves are still protected by the Federal Endangered Species Act and much of the rest of the lower 48, including the western two-thirds of Oregon. Unfortunately, we understand that the Obama administration is, again, leaning towards delisting wolves from the rest of the lower 48. This time it wouldn't be through an act of Congress. This time it would be the administration making that decision. If wolves delist from the Endangered Species Act at the federal level, state management gets all the more important. And so that's why it's so important that we actually have a good plan that will allow wolf recovery to happen in a place like Oregon. And it's interesting to note that in 2012, because of the legal challenge to Oregon's wolf-killing program, we saw, not surprisingly, the wolf population in Oregon increase from 29 to 46 known wolves, which is still obviously very, very endangered. But we also saw conflict with the livestock industry go down. In 2012, only four of Oregon's 1.3 million cows were lost to wolves. And that was something that a lot of scientists said that we would see, because wolves are not like other species. They have a complex social structure, and when you disturb that, you end up with less efficient hunters that are more likely to get themselves in trouble. And so, again, what we saw in places like Idaho and Montana and Wyoming, where they had these aggressive killing seasons, were a decrease in wolf numbers and an increase in conflict. Meanwhile, in Oregon, we had this one-year experiment where we didn't kill wolves, implemented non-lethal measures to prevent conflict, and it worked, and we saw less conflict with the livestock industry. So if wolves are delisted on the federal level, that state management gets that much more important.
That was Rob Clavins, a wildlife advocate with Oregon Wild.
Residents living near the Hillsboro Airport may soon be hearing gunfire in addition to airplanes after a city council vote last night. KBOO reporter Jamai Cherry explains.
Amidst expansion plans for a new runway, the Port of Portland has received permission from the Hillsboro City Council to shoot and disperse or kill coyotes and other wildlife on the airport property.
Item B, consider adopting an ordinance amending Section 7.08.010 of the Hillsboro Municipal Code relating to the discharge of weapons to address wildlife hazards at the Hillsboro Airport. Ordinance number 6051 is available. Do I have a motion to approve the first reading of ordinance number 6051?
So move. Second.
Is there any discussion? Debbie, roll call, please.
Councilor Lumaco?
Yes.
Noctegal?
Yes.
Acuna?
Yes.
Braves?
Yes.
Callaway?
Yes.
Carlson?
Yes. The first reading of ordinance number 6051 passes. The second reading, consideration of final adoption of the ordinance.
That was the initial reading of the ordinance that, like its second and final reading last night, had no discussion. The vote adjusts an ordinance that largely restricts the discharge of firearms within city limits. Though the vote was not unanimous, city councilors approved the change with minimal discussion or public input. This is Jamai Cherry with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30-ish, followed by Treasures from the KBOO Archives at 6. In honor of LGBTQ Month, we will be airing two current affairs pieces on queer issues from the 1990s. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 84 degrees.
It's 5:29 in the post-meridian. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you're covered in political stink, it might be prudent to avoid yelling dirty politics at others. Lately, a mess of right-wing Tea Party groups have been wailing nonstop that they've been targeted and harassed by aboministic IRS thugs. The groups certainly are right that it's abhorrent for a powerful agency to run a repressive witch hunt against any group of citizens just because of their political views. Liberals have certainly felt the lash of such official repression by assorted McCarthyite, Nixonite, Cheneyite forces over the years, and it must be condemned no matter who the victims. In this case, however, the right-wing groups were not targeted by government snoops and political operatives, but tagged by their own applications to be designated by the IRS as 501c4, quote, social welfare groups. This privileged status would allow them to take unlimited bags of corporate cash without ever revealing to voters the names of the corporations putting up the money. The caveat is that 501c4s are supposed to do social welfare work and cannot be attached to any candidate or party, nor can politics be their primary purpose. Forget what the rule says, though. Such renowned political players as Karl Rove and the Koch brothers have cynically set up their own pretend welfare groups, openly using them as fronts to run secret money election campaigns. Suddenly, hundreds of wannabes were demanding the special C4 designation, brazenly lying about their overt political purpose, with some even asserting that they were engaged in no political activity.